This is the Reason interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. Please subscribe to this podcast at Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts, or go to reason.com/podcasts and sign up there. Do immigrants bring with them the worst attributes of the countries and societies they are fleeing? The fear that they do motivates anti-immigrant sentiments from populists and nationalists such as Donald Trump, who famously declared at the start of his campaign for the presidency that when Mexico sends its people, they're not sending their best. It also stokes anxiety from an influential group of mostly free market economists such as Harvard's George Borjas, Britain's Paul Collier, and George Mason's Garrett Jones, who speculate that mass immigration from countries with illiberal or failed political and economic cultures will ultimately undermine countries such as the United States and the United Kingdom. In the new book, Wretched Refuse, The Political Economy of Immigration and Institutions, Alex Narasta and Benjamin Powell take an exhaustive look at the data, and they conclude that destination countries not only benefit economically from immigration, but that many key markers of liberal democracy, such as support for the rule of law, belief in private property, and trust in government, actually improve when newcomers arrive en masse. Here is the Reason interview with Alex Narasta of the Cato Institute and Ben Powell of Texas Tech University. Alex, Ben, thanks for joining me.
Great to be.
Thanks for having me.
Ben, give me the elevator pitch of the book.
Sure. Economists estimate that if we went to a policy of unrestricted immigration around the globe, we could massively increase global output while essentially eliminating global poverty. But this is conditional on the factors that make us productive in the first world and destination countries remaining in place. And we think the greatest challenge to the economist's case for essentially open borders is the threat that immigrants could bring with them the beliefs and customs that are responsible for the institutions in their home countries that are responsible for their poverty. If those institutions migrated with them, then that whole case could blow up. And our book empirically assesses the merits of this new case against immigration.
So this is, I mean, it's related or it's adjacent to Donald Trump's famous declaration in 2015 that when Mexico, sends us immigrants, they're not sending us their best. Essentially, the new argument against immigration is that, you know, when you bring in a lot of people from other countries, shithole countries, as Donald Trump called them famously, they're going to bring their shithole institutions with us and drag us all down. Alex, who is making this argument and why has it come to this?
So this argument has been made by a lot of very good and well-respected economists like George Borjas at Harvard University, Paul Collier in the United Kingdom, and economists like Garrett Jones at George Mason University, who are generally, you know, pro-market economists. They understand the economic efficiency argument for free immigration, but they're justifiably worried or, you know, possibly worried about how this could affect institutions. You know, these are mostly sort of economists on the right side of things or conservatives or libertarians. They understand that free markets are the reason why we're rich in countries like the United States and in Europe and in East Asia. And poor people in poor countries are poor because, well, they don't have those institutions.
Isn't
so if they bring them with them, it's a disaster.
But I mean, that's their argument, right? Is there and we'll walk through the more recent economic analysis, but just from a historical perspective, and I guess, Alex, let me continue with you. You know, this argument is not exactly new. I mean, this was one of the, you know, when if you look back at the iconography of anti-immigrant sentiment, and, you know, starting in the late 19th century through the big European restriction bills that were passed in the early 20s, this is what people were always worried about, that the Italians, the Jews, the Poles, the Irish were not just bringing themselves, which was horrifying enough, but that they were going to bring all of the popish predilections that they had, or the weird religion and the funny food and the anarchy, the predilection and predisposition towards chaos, etc. Historically, this is not how it's worked, is it?
No, it's never been the case as far as we can tell. In many cases, it's the exact opposite. You know, immigrants coming in make native-born people in the U.S. Less likely to support these types of institutions, to support bigger government, to support welfare states because they don't want to give these benefits to foreigners who are coming in to the United States. So frankly, it works basically in the opposite direction. Mm-hmm. But this argument, right, like you mentioned, there's been the argument that immigrants are bringing crime. They're bringing their, you know, their disgusting cuisine. They're bringing, you know, terrorism and all these arguments. So this is like another species of that. Right. It's just like a very specific one that is made currently in the United States by a lot of folks who are sort of more on the right wing spectrum or libertarians.
Yeah. And you know, Nick, actually, reason listeners will probably be interested. We're arguing against what we call the new case for immigration restrictions, but it is an old case and one that Ludwig von Mises even articulated a version of when he wrote Liberalism in the 1920s. He recognized that the economic case for free trade and labor was just like goods and services. But he said the problem is with this interventionist state, the immigrants could turn the state apparatus against the natives, and then this problem becomes insolvable. So this is something that, you know, hardcore free market economists have had some reservations about in the past.
And, you know, you guys get this because you write specifically and voluminously on this topic, but I'm sure you get the idea of like, so we're going to, you know, the Democratic Party is importing massive numbers of voters who are going to somehow make Medicare and Social Security even worse than it is and just overwhelm the economy. Let's start with, you know, I guess, but you're talking about the economics. What is the case? And Ben, why don't you start with this? You know, how do we know that this case is unfounded? Or when you look at the empirical data, we shouldn't be worrying about this.
Well, I think it merits enough worry for Alex and I to do a right. book like this and for your listeners to buy it.
Right.
But what I would say is, so we can walk through the empirics kind of as we go through this interview with you, but just taking the kind of idea of it at first, I think what a lot of people are missing is two factors. One is there's a selection bias in who moves. So when Cubans leave Cuba and move to South Florida, they're not Cubans who want to recreate Cuban socialism. They're the most anti-socialist voting bloc in the United States. Similarly, but to a lesser extent, you know, interstate migration, the Californians who are fleeing Gavin Newsom's lockdown state there and moving to Texas are not the type of people who want to recreate California in Texas for the most part. So that's one part of the story.
Can I ask, though, you know, on that and thinking about it as interstate, just within the United States, Vermont used to be the most conservative state, the most limited government state, along with New Hampshire and maybe Maine. Hippies from New York started migrating up there in the 60s. And now Vermont is, you know, depending on who's talking, a socialist playground or a socialist hellhole. Are you know, can you confidently say that, you know, the people who flee high tax, high regulation states, you know, when they move to isn't Arizona more like California now after a couple of decades of Californians fleeing to Arizona to escape California?
So to be clear, our book is about international right. migration, which doesn't come with the same sort of immediate voting rights that you get with interstate migration. I was really using that just for illustrative right. purposes to start with on selection bias. But that said, in our conclusion of our book, we explicitly say, we don't have a QED here that everywhere and always there is going to be no instance of this. What we have is a general relationship that points in the other direction for the most part. And then we can play with the ideas mm-hmm. too, Nick, of in the presence of these externalities, when they do exist like this, what would policy look like? Because it doesn't turn into a closed border type policy that many would have you think.
Yeah. Alex, could you, Ben mentioned, you know, the economic case, and there's a wonderful demographer, economist, Michael Clemens, who a while back talked about, you know, the idea of having free immigration, of basically getting rid of virtually all immigration restrictions and letting people move to the places they want to live and work, was that we were leaving trillion-dollar bills on the sidewalk. It's a really powerful message, and I totally buy it, but I also am kind of predisposed towards, independent of economic issues, letting people move where they want. Could you briefly kind of recapitulate Clemens' argument? Like, why would letting people move to where they want to move massively improve global economic activity?
So people in different countries have massively different amounts of productivity. So from like the average developing world, worker, if that worker came to the United States, they'd be between 4 and 6 times as productive as they are in their home countries. Because here in the US, we have more free markets, relatively more contract rights, As a result, people have invested and created more businesses and productivity. And one of the things we know about labor market economics is that, you know, the demand curve for labor is determined by the worker's productivity. So if you boost the worker's productivity, the amount that they can get paid will go up by, you know, by between 4 and 6 times if they're 4 and 6 times more productive being here. So if you move, you know, if millions of people, tens of millions, maybe hundreds of millions of people move, and they're all 4 to 6 times more productive than in their home countries, that's probably the biggest boost to global economic output from any single policy change that you can imagine.
And the idea with that, and let me, this is a role I'm very, you know, well-versed in, of playing the kind of idiot asking obvious questions that I struggle with sometimes. But I mean, the idea here is that if a North Korean worker moves from North Korea to South Korea, they're going to be in a situation where, the, you know, if they're on they're on a factory line, they don't even have to be that much different, but the machines that they operate and the system they're in is just that much more productive. So where people work matters as much as how well they work.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And frankly, where they work matters a lot more. I mean, if like an illiterate worker in the United States today is going to be far better off than an illiterate worker, say, in Mozambique today, just because they're going to have access to much better management that's going to be more effective, better machines, like you said, better coworkers and richer consumers who can afford to buy that person's production. So it's part of this whole system that's made more efficient by free markets and free exchange.
Can you guys address, you know, one of the basic questions, especially when we start to raise the specter of unlimited or free immigration, as you say, where it's virtually, you know, anybody who wants to can move to wherever they want to. Won't everybody move to the United States? And, you know, then hence, and if they're in the southwest corner, you know, the continental tip over or something. But what would you guess are the natural limits on if America actually just dropped its immigration restrictions? What are we looking at in terms of the surge of people that would be coming here?
Sure. Well, first, I think we need to recognize, right, that we have a lot of space here in the United States. I'm talking to you from Lubbock, Texas, Nick. There's not a heck of a lot in between you and I right now before the Southwest falls in the ocean.
Yeah. And that is also true north, south, east, or any direction from Lubbock. You are millions of miles from civilization.
No, we have civilization. We're in Texas after all, Nick.
Yes.
but I'd say generally that you'd see some of the richest areas in the world are some of the most densely populated areas. So it's not that we're going to run out of space by many more people coming in. And these things do, diaspora dynamics take time. At first, it's a smaller flow and it will build over time. It's similar to what was, and then it'll peter off after a bit, similar to what's happened with, you know, Puerto Rico in the United States, where we do have free migration between them.
But there's nobody left in Puerto Rico, right? Everybody has left. You know, and I mean, it's kind of, to your point, I mean, these things are kind of sticky, right? Because Puerto Rico over the past decade has had some really horrible natural disasters, and yet people kind of insist on staying there.
Yeah, some people stay there for a variety of reasons, right? It's not all just wage differentials that matter to people. And the same will be true in a context of open borders. But many will come over time. And one of the natural checks on it will then be what happens to housing prices, what happens to jobs. And as it becomes less affordable to move places as they build up, it'll slow down that dynamic a little bit. But as long as there's gains from trade for people, they're going to continue moving. And we should do that as a good thing. We don't get the benefits of open migration without massive numbers of them moving.
And one of the things you guys, I mean, what's interesting about the book is that you're really focusing on the economic arguments, because most of the people you're talking about, I mean, they talk about bringing bad institutions or, you know, the effects of bad institutions to the country. But fundamentally, the people making this new case against immigration are not culture warriors in the old sense, right? They're not saying that they won't learn English or they will continue to eat disgusting food that somehow offends people who are walking by an ethnic restaurant. They're talking about it more in terms of the economic impact on the United States. Is that accurate?
It's accurate, but it's a very particular economic way of looking at it. So most of the economics literature on migration is all about labor market impacts and fairly small scale stuff, really, in my mind, of, you know, how how negative might the effect on high school dropouts be by unskilled laborers? How these are small potatoes questions. This, what we're addressing here, is the big question. If there is a spillover effect outside of the productivity gains they get in their wages, that does something to harm these institutions. And they could be our formal rules, laws, economic freedoms, informal norms of social trusting and culture. If whatever it is, those factors that make us productive, if those get degraded, then their wage gains go down. You don't get that 4 to 6 fold increase Alex is talking about. And worse, our wages go down because now we don't have as good an environment for us to interact in. Then those $1 trillion gains become potentially losses. So the big stuff's at stake in this debate.
Alex, you know, why, and I guess maybe it's unfair to ask you to psychoanalyze people that you disagree with, but why are they making this case now? Because if in fact, you know, the economic arguments are pretty clear cut, you know, and these are economists by and large, what's going on? Why is this, why has the immigration discussion gotten to this point, particularly people broadly defined on the right who have always been, or not always, but I mean, certainly in the late 20th century, conservative economists, libertarians, free market economists have been generally very favorable towards more immigration rather than less immigration.
Yeah, so I love to psychoanalyze my opponents. I'll never shy away from that pleasure.
Yeah.
I think a lot of it has to do with the current political system and disagreements over the last 15, 20 years. So, like, to give you an example, I'm from Southern California. I grew up in LA. And I remember the debate there in 1994 over Prop 187 and Pete Wilson and sort of the Republican Party becoming very, not just anti-illegal immigration, but anti-legal immigration at that time in that state. And one of the big worries that people had was they're all going to vote Democratic forever. This is going to become a one-party state. And as California goes, so does the country. And we've seen that sort of magnified nationwide by President Donald Trump and the Republican Party. And the interesting thing is we did see that in California. Like, California went from being a, you know, a fairly balanced state, at least internally, to a one-party state. But ironically, it was the Republican Party attacks on the fastest growing demographic in the state that led to that. So it's oftentimes like the reaction that does this. But in a lot of people's minds, they think, well, if we didn't have any of these immigrants in the first place, there'd be no way for the Republican Party to commit suicide and we could save them.
And it's, I mean, it's bizarre. We, you know, if we had kept Mexicans out, and I was in California in Los Angeles during the 187 election too, you know, if we had only kept it kind of white and blonde, kind of like Ben, to be quite honest, you know, then the Republican Party wouldn't have revealed itself as kind of crypto racist. And then, you know, and California became a one party supermajority state, which is horrible and people are fleeing. Interestingly, I moved from California to Texas, which has had a very different kind of relationship, particularly with Mexicans at the time. And what happened in Mexico, or excuse me, what happened in Texas, Alex? In the 90s, we saw what the rise of people like George W. Bush, who was routinely getting 40% or more of the Latino vote. So is, you know, that's an object lesson that Republicans don't have to be super exclusionary if they want to have a political future.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Like when George W. Bush ran for governor in 1990 in Texas, he got about 20 to 25% of the Hispanic vote. In 94, when he ran for re-election, he got half the vote. Pete Wilson, it's exactly flipped. You know, Pete Wilson was the California Republican. He got about 50% in 1990, and then that halved when he ran on this anti-immigration platform. So a lot of it is, you know, it's not just how the immigrants believe or how they think and how they come in affects the society. It's how natives react to them as well. And there are reactions that natives have that push us towards sort of more of a free market policies, or at least slow down the growth of government. And then the reactions that do the opposite. And Texas and California sort of both show that. But, you know, the really funny conceit about all of this is, you know, the time period in American history when immigration was the most closed, which is basically from like the mid-1920s to the late 1960s, is a period of time when we had the New Deal. We had the Great Society program. We had, you know, we had mass conscription for most men in the United States. At that time, we had the biggest growth in the size of the federal government. Since then, it's grown, but it's been relatively flat. It's been flatter anyway than during that time period. So, you know, all the correlations basically go in the opposite direction. It's not more immigration, more government. It's basically more government all the time, but a lot more when the borders are closed.
Right. And you would argue that that's partly because there's a kind of ethnic or racial, I wince even thinking about this kind of stuff, but that there's a racial or ethnic solidarity. So it's, you know, there's a reason why Swedes, you know, or monocultures tend to have big welfare states, because the argument is that you're more likely to give free money to people who kind of look and sound and eat like you.
Yeah, there's a big political science literature that makes that argument, that looks at basically Northern Europe and sees all these people coming in, immigrants in the last 20, 30 years, and support for welfare, support for big government has fallen in those places amongst natives. But I think another aspect of this is that immigrants undermine labor unions. And labor unions historically in this country and other countries have been one of the number one institutions pushing for larger government by organizing their members, by organizing their, you know, to lobby for bigger government to vote for it. And the one thing we know about immigration is that they undermine labor unions. So while that sort of ethnic argument may make sense, and there's some definitely some evidence for it, I'm much more comfortable in the US with the, it kills labor unions. And by killing labor unions, you basically kill the number one American institution pushing for larger government, higher taxes, and less economic freedom. So in a way, by hurting one American institution, labor unions, immigration really helped the rest of it, the productive institutions flourish.
Yeah, and you know what's kind of funny, Nick, too, you heard it here first, Alex and I agree with Marx and Engels, because if you look at Marx and Engels' writing in the 19th century, they bemoaned the open immigration to the United States and what it was doing to slow the labor union socialist movement here.
Ben, could you also speak to an interesting, kind of correlation, which is that it seems this happened in the 1920s. America became more and more restrictionist. In the 1990s, America, certainly California, became more restrictionist as the economy was actually doing pretty well. There's one argument that people become anti-immigrant when the economy is in the tank, because people think of things as zero sum. So if somebody from another country is showing up here and they're going to underbid you for labor, you're screwed. But a lot of the times, anti-immigration sentiment kind of seems to be at a fever pitch when people are actually doing pretty well.
I don't know. You know, Alex can probably answer this better than me. It seems like people have a pretty constant amount of anti-immigrant rhetoric here in the United States. And it's just the direction of that rhetoric changes from one target to another, depending on the mood of the day.
You know, to kind of dilate on this a little bit, one of the things that is amazing to me, and I know at Reason, and I'm sure you guys do this at your institutions as well, a couple of times a month, probably, one of us will go back and rediscover this incredible video of George H.W. Bush and Ronald Reagan during the race for the 1980 Republican presidential nomination. They had a debate in Houston where they are outbidding each other to say illegal immigrants are an accepted part of the fabric of the American labor market and of our culture, and we need to do more to welcome illegal immigrants. When you look at that, it is like, you know, Man in the High Castle. It is like a video, a film that was made in an alternate reality and then got piped into here. When you look at the, the way Republicans in particular talk about immigration, what happened to the Republican Party that it became captured by, anti-immigrant sentiment, regardless of Donald Trump? Mitt Romney was talking about how, he ran in 2012 on a policy of self-deportation by immigrants, that was the best way forward. What happened to the Republican Party that it went from being relatively welcoming to immigrants to absolutely being against it?
So
against it.
Let me not answer you here in a little bit of a way, and then Alex can maybe answer you. Because I want to be clear, actually, in our book, Republicans versus Democrats plays a very, very small role. It's about the institutions and the policies, and that's only loosely related to R&D. Both of them are statist on some margins, more liberal on other margins. And what we really care about in terms of the argument that we're addressing. Will immigrants undermine the institutions that make us prosperous? We don't care what channel it comes through of R&D. We care about how it impacts the actual policy and institutions. And that's where we're not
finding. And it's worth pointing out that the actual policies are in some ways, and Trump is, you know, perhaps sui generis in this, but, you know, the difference in immigration policy between George W. Bush and Barack Obama, it's probably not worth writing home about in terms of the number of people who are allowed here to come and work and live under various circumstances. Alex, do you want to address the political question, though, at all?
Yeah, it's a weird sort of conundrum, because if you go back to the 70s and 80s, the big folks who were anti-immigrant in the U.S., you know, associated with John Tanton and his network, they were all a bunch of left-wingers who are trying to influence the Democratic Party, get labor unions more on board, being more anti-immigrant for this sort of environmental reason. They thought immigrants are people, they're coming here, more people is bad for the environment, so we need to stop them. And they sort of hit a brick wall in the 1980s and then had some real luck in California, basically, with the fear over illegal immigration. So I think the big thing that really flipped people in the recent era is just that we have illegal immigration because the border is so restricted. And that brings up all these worries about crime, about national security, with sort of illegal invaders, right, crossing our border, which trip a whole bunch of different circuit breakers in people's minds and make them like very angry about immigration, which is not that different from in the 1920s, where people were very worried about the socialist revolutions overseas, about communists coming over and spreading revolution, illegally entering the United States. There were hundreds of terrorist attacks back then. The LA Times building was bombed, for instance, and the largest bombing up until that time, or one of the largest bombings in the United States. So a lot of these sort of, as soon as sort of national security and illegality comes into play, people become very worried in a way where if these guys are coming over to work a job, people don't care as much. But if they're coming over as part of some international revolution, or in an age of terrorism, it really makes people worried.
Is one of the institutions as kind of a respect, or, you know, attitudes, mindsets, is a respect for rule of law. And this is, I've had countless conversations with people who say, I'm not against legal immigration, I'm against illegal immigration. What is the status of illegal immigration now versus legal immigration? And, and did you find, or do you find, that having large numbers of illegal immigrants or undocumented immigrants actually undermines respect for rule of law?
So in our data, when we actually analyze immigration flows, we're lumping legal and illegal all together and saying, what's the net effect on institutions? And no, we actually find measures of economic freedom, which include the rule of law and enforcement of property rights among those measures, actually increase. So they don't undermine rule of law and property rights. It actually strengthens.
How does that happen, though? Because this is, you're telling me we have like a million or, you know, 12 million illegals flouting the laws of this country, and you're telling me we have more respect for rule of law. What's the mechanism that happens?
Okay, so the mechanism is that this is talking about cross countries that have all different versions of this, measuring a belief in the rule of law and security of property rights, government enforcement of contracts, not the specific issue of are illegal immigrants breaking the law. Those are two separate things. You could have people breaking their law on that doesn't undermine your belief that your contracts will be enforced, that your courts will not be biased and things like that. And I'd say more generally, conceptually, what we have, what's the state of, you said the state of illegal immigration. The state of legal immigration in the United States is basically it's impossible for almost everybody. So illegal immigration is the path. And if we have something that I would say is a law that is against the rule of law, namely mass restrictions on anybody coming across the border to immigrate, that's inconsistent with the rule of law. And breaking such a law is both moral, just, and not inconsistent with rule of law.
Yeah. And one of the things we take a look at sort of in some detail in the book is whether immigrants have more trust in our institutions. So whether they have more trust in like the legal system, whether they have more trust in American businesses, whether they have more trust, you know, just in the general sense of government and the way things are run here. And overwhelmingly, they do. If it weren't for immigrants in the United States, trust in institutions would be a lot lower.
And it's low, but it would be at zero, right? I mean, because it is people who come from really awful places come here and they're like, oh, it's not perfect, but it beats where I'm from.
Yeah, I mean, like, I remember being young and talking with my grandfather who immigrated from Iran, and I was complaining about something about Congress. And he said, when I was your age, there was a military coup, and a bunch of my family friends got thrown in jail and had all their property taken. So, you know, compared to that, American institutions are like a paradise. And we'd say, well, it's just a matter of time before the immigrants and their kids figure it out. But it also might just be that we're kind of spoiled, right? We don't understand how good we have it in the United States, even though, you know, I'm a libertarian, Ben's a libertarian, you know, we're all libertarians here, right? We want things to be very different. But the immigrants sort of make us realize that however bad things are here now and however many complaints we have, they are a lot worse in other places. And we have a lot to really be thankful for the institutions that we have. And we don't really have to be worried that the immigrants are undermining them. They like our institutions too, and generally more than we do.
Yeah. Nick, if we could just broaden this out and step outside the United States a little bit too, because we look at other countries and case studies of them too. And a dramatic example right along these lines is Israel during the 1990s. So Israel has always had an open immigration policy to worldwide Jews and descendants of Jews. And when the Soviet Union lost its emigration restrictions, a massive flood of people coming from a country with a 70-year history of no rule of law, no economic freedoms, pile into Israel with immediate voting rights too because of the law of return. It increased the population of Israel by about 20% in that decade. That's a big immigrant shift. And confidence in property rights didn't go down, it went up. Economic freedoms across the board, except size of government, also increased because their welfare state didn't change. It's just the amount of money being transferred did because they were poorer when they first arrived. But that recovered. Overall, Israel went something from like 90th in the world in economic freedom to 45th during a period of massive immigration from a communist country. So this happened with, now in their case, legal migration, but strengthening the rule of law and economic freedoms in a major way.
Could we talk a little bit about entitlements, though, and particularly in a United States context? Medicare and Social Security are the main drivers of long-term debt, particularly Medicare. We are reaching a crisis point with a lot of these, the trust funds that fund these things. Social Security been around since the Depression. As Alex pointed out, in a way that I don't think gets enough discussion, Medicare, which was, you know, called by LBJ the final act of the New Deal, came in this period of relative immigration exclusion. What is the effect of mass immigration? Like, you know, because these institutions, these old age entitlements are probably more popular than ever. Isn't immigration just kind of like, it's the final match on top of the Molotov cocktail? I'm sorry, this is a terrible metaphor, but is there any reason to believe that large-scale immigration wouldn't just explode those entitlements, yeah, you know, more quickly?
Yeah, actually, although I would pitch this the opposite way. If I were asked what's an argument against immigration, I would say that it makes Social Security and Medicare more sustainable for a longer period of time. Overwhelmingly, the immigrants tend to be younger and of working age. And these things are Ponzi schemes. They depend on drawing more people in. Our birth rate isn't such that that's the case. If you let millions upon millions of people come in, it doesn't change the fact that they're still Ponzi schemes and will go bankrupt. It just delays the day of reckoning farther out. But for native-born Americans who want to collect, most of them would probably view that as a good thing. I just am weird because I view it as a negative.
Alex, could you explain to me, and by extension, the audience, you marshal a huge amount of economic data, and, you know, and this is people like George Borjas, obviously, you know, cops to this, and is that the overall long run wage effect, and I'm quoting from the book now, the overall long run wage effect in the U.S. economy on immigrant and native born American workers at all levels of education combined of immigration is roughly zero. How is that possible?
So very broadly, right, immigration increases the supply of workers. It also
so that brings prices, that should bring wages down.
It should,
right?
Bring wages.
All things being equal.
You'd think, right? But then you also, right, immigrants are workers, are consumers. They buy things, they make things in the U.S., and as a result, demand goes up as well. And, you know, what we were talking about earlier is the demand curve for labor. You know, like there's a demand curve for everything. The demand curve for labor is determined by how much the worker can make, by how productive they are. And by coming here and by being more productive, their wages and the wages for the entire general economy go up. You know, the rest of the economy adjusts, and by buying things, demand for goods and services increases. So it's like, you know, more people are a benefit. It's sort of Julian Simon 101 when you think about it, is, you know, more people are a blessing. More people do not increase poverty. They lead to increased productivity, more consumers, more things being made. And that's, you know, the general finding. And over time, the effect of immigration on wages, immigration by itself, is basically zero. And all these guys will admit it.
That's, by the way, lumping everybody together, too. Because, of course, what we really have is like segmenting that labor market.
I wanted to get to that because, you know, so one of the things that we always used to hear was that, well, you know, broad or massive numbers of immigrants, particularly low-skilled workers, that was bad because it hurt Americans who either had a high school degree or less than a high school degree, and that was bad. Increasingly, and you kind of show, a data that actually suggests that that's overplayed, or that to the extent it's a problem, it can be addressed through other kind of interventions and help for people. But increasingly, we hear more and more that it's actually H-1B visa people, that we're bringing in all of these South Asian computer programmers and like Silicon Valley people now. You know, people who went and got an engineering degree in college, et cetera, their wages are being brought down by massive numbers of highly skilled workers in STEM industries. Is that not true?
Yeah. So if you directly compete with immigrant labor, as in have the same skill set, you can see a decrease in your wages. It's usually temporary in most of the markets and then recovers. For the vast majority of us, we don't have skills that directly compete with immigrants that come in. So in that case, they would actually make us more productive by being a complement to us rather than a substitute. What you see is a reshuffling, because even if it's literally the same programming skills in whatever computer language, there's another language that they also differ in, speaking of English. And what you tend to see then is people reshuffling at the low skill end of things. This is you get your roofer displaced by an immigrant, but then that guy becomes the subcontractor who talks to the customers. At the high skill end of things, you cease being the computer programmer, but are the manager of the computer programmers who talks to the marketing guys.
Right. So if you're a janitor in LA and you started your career in 1980, you would probably have lower wages today if you were still a janitor. But what happens is that janitor changes his career in response to all these immigrants. He sort of becomes the manager. He moves on up. He manages all these folks and has higher wages. So, you know, sort of in embedded in this argument that immigrants take American jobs and lower the wages is the idea that Americans never adjust to a changing market and are stuck in their ways. And what we see by taking a look at these labor markets over time is that, no, Americans are very adjustable, and they generally adjust to immigration by moving up the occupation skills ladder to make higher wages.
Among the other aspects, and you know, this is really the heart of the new argument against immigration that you're addressing, is that, well, you know, these people bring the worst attributes of their native countries. And in the teens and the 20s, this was kind of like the Emma Goldman case, right? That Emma Goldman flees, Russia, incipient Soviet Russia, and is an anarchist, and then comes here and, you know, writes and talks a lot about anarchism. And my God, you know, then we became an anarchist country and, you know, everything went down the tubes. What are the attributes that the new restrictionists, like, what do they most fear when Mexicans come here? You know, let's say, okay, they're not drug, you know, they're not bringing drugs, they're not rapists, they're not bringing disease. What are the mindsets, or what are the bad institutional temperaments, mindsets, experience that people worry about, you know, Mexicans or Iranians or, Swedes or something? What are they bringing that is supposedly so bad?
So, Nick, you know, it's in their own writing on this, they leave it very vague and broad. It's that they come from countries with bad formal and informal institutions that are responsible for, at least to a degree, for their poverty. And they're going to bring these informal norms with them and beliefs that could change our legal and formal institutions or informal, without specifying. What we do in the book is we go through and look at formal institutions of economic freedom. We look at levels of corruption. We look at levels of social trust. We look at rates of crime and terrorism and how it's related. Things that plausibly fit the mold of the general thing that they're saying. But they don't put their finger on one and say, that's it.
I have to say, I mean, I think you, you know, this book is, it's on my Christmas gift list. I'm going to give it to various people. But you guys kind of, you did their work for them, because what's frustrating is that they're like, you know, we're not saying, like, I mean, as you talked about, somebody like George Borjas, who is, you know, a very good technical economist who has shown time and again that immigration doesn't really have that bad an effect on wages and labor markets and things like that. But then they're like, oh, but you know what? There's this hypothetical problem that these guys are going to really, these newcomers are going to screw up the country. But they don't talk about it. And then you work through that. I mean, Alex, why were you such a sucker to do these guys' homework for them?
Yeah, I think that's like a good summary of my entire career is, you know, people write about immigrants bringing crime or poverty and they use an anecdote. And
in the end, like all they bring is garlic, right? I mean, that's basically what they, you know, you can almost from everywhere. It's just that they brought, you know, good spices.
Yeah, they brought in the good introduction to the op-ed, right? But they didn't bring in any of the facts that go into the middle. So I guess I am a sucker. That's my entire career. But immigration is very important for all the economic reasons like we lay out, for Americans, for immigrants, et cetera. And I want to know if I'm wrong. I want to know if my arguing for free immigration to the United States would actually undermine and destroy all the things that I really care about. So answering this question, you know, in part I'm a sucker because I'm, you know, answering my critics who didn't bother to formalize any of their arguments. But another way, I just want to know if I'm wrong. And I want to know if I ever succeed, would I actually end up doing harm? And so an exercise like this, you know, I think that's worth spending a book or two books or maybe even more trying to figure out the answer to that question, because more important than answering my critics, I want to know if I'm fundamentally mistaken.
Alex, could you talk, and Ben, I'll ask you the same question. Can you, you've mentioned that you're of Iranian descent. And I suppose if you were in Southern California, you were passing as Persian for a while, right? But what is your family history with immigration, and how much does that affect, you know, kind of how you think about this stuff?
So I'm a halfie. I'm half. You know, my grandparents came from Iran in the 40s. So I'm third generation. I don't speak Farsi. I'm not a Muslim. I don't know even much about Iranian culture.
You're not even a secret Muslim?
No, not even a secret Muslim. You know, according to my hate mail, I'm either a secret Jew or a secret Muslim or a combination.
Those Muslim Jews they're a crafty bunch. For sure.
Let me tell you, we have these secret meetings and you wouldn't be invited, Nick. But the other side.
My grandparents were all immigrants. So I feel your pain and I, you know, but continue.
Yeah. And then, you know, the other half of my family, my mom's side is just all just American mutts from Northern and Western Europe, you know, Jews and Protestants and pretty typical. So, I mean, my story is unremarkable. I don't really have a personal story. It's just a pretty American story. The reason I'm so interested in immigration is because the economic gains are vast and I'm a huge nerd who loves economics and that's my background. And then secondly, it's not boring, because it touches on every single aspect of social science. You know, I can study wages and how immigration affects that. And if that gets boring, I can study crime. If crime gets boring, I can study terrorism. If terrorism gets boring, I can study American history. If that gets boring, I can study the effect of institutions. And when I'm done with that, wages are interesting again. And it's something that really, you know, it allows me to study this country of ours, which has historically done immigration, I think managed immigration, at least until the early 20th century, better than any other country in the world. And that's something to be proud of and something that I want to return to.
Ben, what is COP2? What's your 23andMe? What's the elevator pitch of your 23andMe case?
Well, I haven't had a swab, but I'm a English, Welsh, French, German, French Canadian, touch of American Indian.
You
in there
are the people
mixed.
Who beat up my grandparents from Ireland and Italy. So I thank you. Really, they deserve.
Oh yeah, Irish too. I've got some that go back to the 1640s here, and others that are early 20th century. So really, my personal immigration story isn't an international one. It's moving to the Great Republic of Texas from Massachusetts to found a group called the Free Market Institute. So I'm probably the type of in-migrant that's going to promote liberty in Texas rather than take it away.
Texas is a fascinating, you know, I lived there for 2 years and in a place even more horrible than Lubbock, to be quite honest, Huntsville, Texas. But it's as a kind of microclimate, it is amazing, you know, the number of foreign flags that Texas has flown or lived under. And the way that it deals with, you know, it is a magnet today for all sorts of new immigrants, old immigrants, and a constant remixing. And it's such a draw for people within the U.S. Do your Massachusetts, do your Mayflower, you know, descendants, are they like, why would you move to Texas? What's wrong with you? I know I got that. Yeah, I moved to Huntsville, Texas from L.A. So people were like, you're going from L.A., to a town that has the Death Chamber of Texas in it. What's in it for you? But
yeah, I was a tenured professor in my hometown of Boston, working right downtown. Heck, my office was next to Sam Adams' grave. It was a great location. But it was just bigger, better opportunity in Texas, the way that Texas tends to offer people bigger and better opportunities.
It's also bigger bullshit artists, by the way, but
I haven't met any of them down here, Nick.
Well, let me, as a final kind of conversation point, can I ask you guys what, and again, your book is not, blissfully, it's not about partisan politics. It's about something much more profound than that and meaningful. But we're coming out of an era where Donald Trump was the most explicitly xenophobic president in, you know, in recent memory. And at the same time, you know, immigrants, when you look at public surveys of, you know, are people are asked, are immigrants good or bad for the country? And we are now at record levels of people saying, you know what, immigrants are pretty good. How does that have any effect on policy? You know, that, you know, a generally favorable attitude towards immigrants in the abstract, does that, or is that completely detached from the way that politics gets done?
So I do think it affects policy. I think our system is set up so that public opinion eventually affects policy. And one interpretation I think of the Donald Trump era is it's sort of like the last, I hope anyway, I think it's like the last gasp. It's like the temper tantrum before everything changes, sort of in the same way that in the mid-1960s, you had a lot of, you know, like George Wallace and others sort of having their large nationwide temper tantrum against the end of segregation. And if you were just looking at what political candidates were saying, you'd say, wow, this segregation stuff is really on the upswing in the mid to late 1960s. But it's really the opposite. It's sort of like the death rattle of it. So, I mean, what you see amongst Republicans, amongst independents, amongst Democrats is either they like immigration as much as they always have, or the favorabilities are going through the roof. Part of that could be a reaction to Donald Trump. Part of you know, Democrats saying, well, we don't like Republicans. Donald Trump is saying all this stuff.
And to that point, a record level of Democrats are in favor of free trade, which they weren't circa 2016. So,
yeah, I mean, in the same sense that, like, we don't care whether it's an R or a D who is pushing these good policies. I mean, I'm willing and happy to work with Democrats as well as I was with Republicans on pushing for immigration and free trade and everything else. But I do think, like, fundamentally, changes in public opinion will affect, you know, public policy eventually. It's just, you know, it's translating it from, you know, a poll to political action just takes a lot of time. It's a messy system.
Ben, could I ask you to comment perhaps on, you know, and it's easy to make light of people who are, you know, really deeply fearful or hateful towards immigrants. But there is a sizable number of people in the country, and this was certainly true of the 1920s, even as it was a boom economy. There was a global restructuring of labor markets, both within the U.S., a shift from the countryside to the city. Globally, things changed dramatically. People are left behind when things change in a big way. What is a good way to talk to people who are fearful of immigration because of what they think it's going to do to their own lives, to their cultural lives and their economic lives. How do you speak to them in a way so that they can at least start to open their eyes or open their minds or hearts to the idea that immigration is not the be-all and end-all of where they are in life?
Well, at least in terms of economic processes, it's not fundamentally different than international trade in goods and services, or even technological change. It's a new technology for production that makes us more productive. And when we do that, overall, we become more prosperous. Anytime, you know, when you move to the assembly line in Henry Ford and cars, the people who worked with horses and buggies got displaced and had to retool in order to advance in the economy. That's true when we change international trade flows. That's true when we change with immigrant flows. But all of these things are part of an overall advancement for us that eventually that tide's going to lift all of the ships. It's just we have to be willing to accept and be in a dynamic society that requires this adjustment if we want the benefits of long-term growth and prosperity.
Yeah, and I think, you know, in the U.S., we have a lot easier time making this argument because we can point back to our Italian, Irish, Welsh, Persian ancestors who came here and face sort of the same criticism that immigrants are facing today, whether it's about institutions like our book is about, or whether it's about economics or anything else. And these fears in the past turned out to be unfounded. And we can make that argument again and again in the U.S. So we do have that that advance or that benefit on our side, that advantage. And we also have the advantage of, you know, the economics being in our favor, and that immigration is good for the United States, good for Americans, good for the immigrants. And the downsides that people talk about are, you know, really small by comparison, or as we discuss in our book, benefits in disguise.
Yeah, I'm one of the things that is phenomenal about the book is it really is an exhaustive, you know, kind of refutation of this vague argument that is put forward. There is so much data in the book that anybody who is a data nerd is just going to be in hog heaven. This is a great Christmas gift to the nativist as well as to the kind of internationalist in your life. We're going to leave it there. I've been talking with Ben Powell and Alex Narasta, the authors of Wretched Refuse, The Political Economy of Immigration and Institutions. Alex, Ben, thanks so much.
Thank you, Nick.
Thanks a bunch.
This has been The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to this podcast at Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts, or go to reason.com/podcasts and sign up there. Thanks for listening.